Okay.
EMS 8730.
Hello, caller?
Relax, relax. We're trying to help you here.
This is not a job for everybody.
Losing fib now.
This is not a job to get rich or stuff like that.
Calm down. Everything's going to be okay.
We're the doctors of the street. That's what we are.
Welcome to EMS Office Hours. This is Jim Hoffman.
And this is Josh Knapp. EMS Office Hours is a live, weekly EMS podcast for all EMS professionals.
Discussing a variety of EMS topics and bringing your EMS concerns to light. So turn down that scanner and turn up your speakers.
And join us to find out what's really on the minds of EMS.
Hey, everybody, this is Jim Hoffman.
And this is Josh Knapp.
And welcome to the first 2012 episode of EMS Officers. So, Josh.
Absolutely. Happy New Year, Jim.
Happy New Year. I hope you had a good holiday and a good New Year, and you're all ready to go for this year's episodes coming up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's going to be an interesting actually, wait a second. Isn't that a Chinese curse? May you live in interesting times?
I don't know.
Yeah, something like that.
The only Chinese is when I order food.
Oh, really?
That's it. Well, Josh, I think you came up with this idea, Josh, of doing a show where we kind of just pick some key topics, kind of short focuses on these little topics, rather than every show being kind of a one topic show where we kind of hammer it down and whatever. And I think there's merit in that, but I think it's also merit what you mentioned too, is kind of getting some of the topics that seem to be popular out there in EMS and on the web. And, giving people a chance to maybe call in and get their opinion on that, or to chat in the chat room about it, or comment, of course, on the blog about it as well. So I have about four different topics that I think we can probably hit, maybe 15 minutes or so on each one. I do have a caller, though, Josh. I want to bring them in before we get started, and maybe we can get them right in on the conversation with us. And I think,
let's do it.
Yeah, I think it's Bob Sullivan's on with it. Bob, is that you?
Yes.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Good. How are you both?
Great.
Hey, Bob. Doing good, man. Doing good.
Well, Bob,
did you have a good New Year?
I did. I was not working, which was probably the best. I had to do that a couple times, and it's one of the days I always look for on the calendar when the shift rotation comes out to see if I'm working that night.
Yeah, it's like a head. So, Jim, did you work New Year's?
No, I was off. I was off that holidays. Yeah, I was off Christmas and New Year's this year for a change. It kind of, made it through each one. I want to go ahead and try to. Some of these topics might not spend too much time on them, because I think some of them are more passionate than others. But I thought it was interesting because I saw one topic that was kind of floating around about the worst jobs of 2011, and they had MT listed as
Jim, before you get rocking and rolling, I just want to give a little background, because, to some of our listeners, they, may not know, you and I have been friends for a long time, and we have conversations beyond the scope of this talk show.
Sure.
And, a lot of our conversations are heated, passionate, but they almost always involve subject EMS. And where my idea came up to, let's talk about some of this stuff in less structured way, maybe more of a random way, although, we have to have some structure,
right,
was from the conversations. So, it's cool that you picked these topics, but I don't want to feel like we're completely locked into them if we stray a little bit.
Well, we always it seems like we stray most of a lot of them anyhow, but, I picked these as a way just to format us a little bit. And like I said, some of these might not take, that long to kind of comment on, but I thought it was interesting how the EMT was listed number six on that list, and read the article on that. They talk about how EMTs have better hiring prospects, but they talk about this. It makes the top 10 because of harsh working conditions, high stress. And my favorite part was what it says, inexcusably low pay, given the important nature of the work.
Yes, that was a mention that got, you know, this was this is not the first time this ranking has been out, and I remember, what was it, a year or two ago, it came out, and I think we actually moved up. I think we were number 5, like, a couple of years ago, and they did not go in. They just mentioned, like, low pay, but I really like that statement, the inexcusable low pay. I mean, that really says a lot, you know. I mean,
sure.
But, you know, for you know, the other side, you're always going to get sort of a good hiring prospect in any of these jobs, don't pay you well, hard to do, and just have a
high turnover. And I think we talked about
high turnover.
I think, Bob, you were on us one of the weeks we discussed that and talked a little bit about, you know, the high turnover rate, how they just want to kind of get people in the seats, and that's you know, part of the issue as far as pay goes as well. But what did you think about that study, or that release of that, you know, them saying it's one of the worst jobs to have?
Well, I was looking at the first thing I thought of. It's kind of opposite ends of the EMS spectrum. When I look at, like, you know, some of the other jobs they mentioned, I thought of flight paramedics, because statistically, the way helicopters crash and you know, the entire crew is always killed, you know, that sort of makes that the most dangerous job in the country or possibly the world. And the other things from the low pay side, which some helicopter services do pay very low, makes me think of the transport companies that come in, have no hiring standards, they pay near minimum wage, sometimes they'll host a sort of abbreviated EMT class to try to get everybody through, and then, you know, they have people that are willing to work 80, 90 hours a week for $7 or $8 an hour. So those are the two. I see the low pay, and then the most dangerous aspect is the helicopter portion. So, you know, when it comes to people that work on oil rigs and things like that. That's,
yeah, I mean, and that's a great point, because they used to say the most dangerous job in America was a taxi cab driver. And yeah, you know, these guys get held all the time, and it's a dangerous job. But you want to know something? Beyond operating a motor vehicle, you don't need any special skills. You don't need any real special training. I mean, there may be some training with it, but it's not hundreds of hours of training. And even on our basic minimum level, you require hundreds of hours of training, and then you have to continue that training throughout the rest of your career. So I think there's, there's it weighs all factors, and there's the other factor of what you have to put into the job. It's actually kind of amazing we are where we are. But, you know, I mean, and I've sort of said this, and I always say this, you know, we own it. If you're in a situation, you gotta sort of take responsibility for that situation,
right,
even if you didn't create it. You know, I mean, you're in that situation. So,
no,
you know,
Josh, reading some of the comments that were made, like, in that article too, a lot of people are, well, my job is harder than this one, and my harder job is harder. How come police didn't make it, or how come firefighters didn't make it in to that list? You know, or somebody said, well, you know, I work for the airport, and I have a tough job there as well, type of thing. It's like, you know, everyone's trying to chime in and say how hard their job is and relating to their pay, and there's a little bit of a, almost like a pissing match going on in the comments, in the thread comments of that article. So
I'll be honest, I ignore the comments, because, you know, anybody and everybody, and some people just to be heard, you know, submitted by anonymous, you know, it's like, my job's tougher than that, you know. But is this really a conversation about how EMS, I mean, do you want to have a conversation of how EMS is perceived by the job experts as being a tough job? I mean, basically, they put all these numbers together, and, you know, on a graph chart, we ended up as number 6 of the 10 worst jobs. But, you know, there are a lot of people who have, you know, made very handsome and very good livings as welders, as, you know, roofers, lumberjacks, any one of these. There's going to be an exception to the rule.
Yeah.
I think, you know, Bob sort of hit it on the point of look at the variance that we get, but there's still a common factor, that common thread that runs through any level of EMS, and that's almost always for what the responsibility that we have, we're under-respected, underpaid, and overworked.
Yeah. No, I have another caller online. Let's see if I can bring them in, see who it is, and get their opinions too if they have one on it. Hi, who is this calling in? It's Jimmy. Hello. Hi, who's this?
It's Tim.
Hey Tim, how's it going? I thought I recognized the handle there. How's Happy New Year?
Happy New Year, Josh.
Well, Tim, just talk a little bit about that. That worst job report that came out and how EMTs were list number six. I just thought I just mentioned the thing that I kind of focused on was that little blurb I mentioned earlier, how it's, you know, inexcusably low pay given the important nature of the work. And I think that that's something I think is a key part of that, you know, considering the other jobs that were listed there.
Well, we pay little, so we take what we can get. It becomes something where it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. We get some people who shouldn't be in the business, and we don't attract people who could do a great job.
Yeah, you know, that's so true. I think it's like you said, a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think that's true to a point, though. We're not paying people out of money, and we're getting pretty much the get what you pay for type thing, and it's not all aspects, but in some aspects of what we're doing.
Yeah, but it's, you know, the only part, you look, yeah, it's self-fulfilling prophecy that we're willing to stay employed where we're being paid. Tim is 100% on the mark. I mean, but the idea of that we accept this job from the get-go, I think a lot of us get into this for not for the reasons of pay, but finding that as we want to become more professional and make it a career, we sort of get sucked into, you know, that cycle of, well, this is the job I have. And keep in mind, the last 10 years have been, you know, very unusual. We've had one of the worst economies around. So it's been very hard, you know, for people to move, much less, you know, a lot of America get a job now.
Yeah, it's been like that before 10 years ago.
Well, you mean with EMS?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's never been a high-paying job except for certain locations, and usually those are union jobs, and usually third service or firefighter jobs.
Right,
they're compared with other city employees or county employees and get paid based on some sort of metric that compares them to the responsibilities of other people working for the government with a similar job. And in the private sector, you usually don't get that. There are some places where privates are paid pretty well, but there are probably a lot more where they're paid with whatever they can get away with.
Right, and that's generally the earmark of, you know, the telltale, I think, of the private sector. You know, that we're going to give you what we think you'll take so we can get the job done. And I've heard too many times it's all about asses and seats. It has nothing to do with, you know, the quality of care delivered. And unfortunately, sometimes I see that. And I know that's been a bitch of yours, Tim, in terms of, you know, a lot of times it's the people you're forced to work with are not exactly the people you would want to see caring for somebody, much less somebody you care about.
Well, the same thing applies to some places that are unionized, whether they're third service, firefighter, county, whatever, because it all depends on what is the motivation of management to assure quality, the highest level of quality that they can. And some people just are interested in looking after their own job and not seeing that the best care is delivered to patients. Our biggest problem is that very few people, even medical directors, understand what we do. You know, we try to get people to understand that this is about doing what's best for the patient, and they think, oh, response times, they think more medics, they think all these other things that I think require that you dilute experience, dilute quality in order to get more employees.
I have two questions, but one is an observation. Part is an observation where, you know, I'll bet that when you take all of the patient care issues down, you know, when you back off of all the patient care issues and take a macro focus on what EMS is about, there's a very, very big correlation. This is unfortunate because it's probably skewing the numbers. Skewing what the real story is in terms of real care delivered and real outcomes, but there's very, very big correlation between time of transport and survivability or something along those lines. And, you know, where my question to you, Tim, is, you know, well, what do you think about, you know, the ranking of number six in the 10 worst jobs? You think that's a fair ranking? You think that it's really not shouldn't be one of the top 10, or is it number one?
You're lumping so many different job descriptions that are all under EMT together in one category, just as, you know, fishermen, commercial fishermen, you've got the North Atlantic fishermen who are often cited as one of the most dangerous jobs, lumped in with somebody who may be, working on a fish farm and not really have any danger in their job. Same thing with EMS. You have people who may work in a tactical squad or fly or, work at high angle rescue and may have higher dangers on the job. You also have people who are extremely unfit and are the ones likely to have the heart attack on the job. And you have people who either drive poorly or work with somebody who drives poorly, and they're the ones likely to have the car crashes and fatality or ambulance crashes and the fatalities that way. I don't think that it gives you a good idea of what any individual EMS worker's job risk is.
You know, I wonder if like I mentioned the pay before, and like you said too, as far as the sort of like the the self-fulfilling prophecy, and it's kind of, I guess I wonder how much it affects things like the topic tonight I was trying to talk about was, as far as providers being videotaped or pictures being taken of them not performing professionally. And I wonder if that pay scale, that attitude of not getting paid much money, kind of trickles down to getting that sort of that apathy to patients that we come in contact with, and then we wind up getting our picture taking not performing to the level that we should be performing at because of how we're perceived with each other and, you know, and what the pay that we're getting. I mean, it was a thing in Oklahoma. I don't know if you guys saw that video or not, where you had the police and the fire and then the EMS crew got there and, you know, this was on the ground. And, I mean, it was what the entire video was because they only had part of the video. Who knows if they actually did an assessment or not, but, you know, they pretty much were dragging her onto the stretcher and just kind of staring and looking at her. Not a lot of care going on, but they were taking pictures of her. The actual fire department crews themselves taking, you know, pictures of the patient laying on the ground and whatever. And I'm wondering, you know, how much, if you saw that video or not, what your take is on it. You know, I think we all have to be vigilant nowadays with all the cameras that are out there. But I'm wondering how much of that perception of what we're doing kind of goes down to our that apathy from on some people.
Well, it certainly looked bad.
Yeah.
And I don't know how it was edited or what was done off camera, but certainly what was filmed didn't reflect highly on us. But it was, I don't want to get into any kind of pissing match between the police and the firefighters, but they were there for a considerable amount of time before the EMSA ambulance showed up. And I don't know what the level of care. I did see a life pack there in the video, and I didn't see them. I don't know when they cut him,
you know, or if cut away at some point and went back, you know, because it seemed like the guy that was the host, whatever, of that show that showed that seemed one of those shady types that, you know, kind of for the big head type thing, you know.
They cut it to make the worst appearance that they can to their point.
But the perception, I think what damages us, and I wonder if that affects, you know, how people feel, how much we should be getting paid after all when they see things like that, you know, going on. When the German
thing. No. It's, well, there's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, I mean, this is the part that gets me. Everybody's amazed when, people have a bad attitude about what we do. And then you come out with videos like this, and it's like, well, you know, are these guys doing anything that they should be doing? I mean, if this was a well-dressed woman in a mall, would they be doing this?
Right, apparently it was a prostitute or something, maybe a drug, known drug person, whatever, a drug area and whatnot. So they had the attitude probably going in with that this is just, you know, one of the norm, one of the burdens that they have to deal with on their as part of their call volume. But, you know, at the time, you have to still, you know, to me, you still have to do that assessment. You still have to do what you have to do because you never know with those people. You might the cry wolf, you know, type thing. You know, you have to still do
and
your assessment.
You, Jim, that's the voice of experience. That's absolutely
popular.
Yeah, no, I can't get this. I can't get this thing.
But that's an annoying ring.
All right. Anyway, yeah. And it's still going too. It's to throw me off. But you were talking about this before. I mean, how many people? And I can't stop it either. So it's just not going to stop. Shut up.
You know how am I going to?
I think it's more the voice of
you're not
being a professional than experience. People will pick it up with experience, but it's having a professional attitude that you don't treat one patient well because they're in a well-to-do neighborhood or they're dressed well or, you know, just because they're a friend of somebody you know. You treat all the patients well, even the ones who yell at you, spit at you, and stuff like that. You do what is necessary to control their behavior, and then, you know, you go back to being a professional caregiver. You do a full assessment. You treat them appropriately. And we have too many people who don't understand that. And I think part of the problem with the videos is you get people who want to be in control. And they see somebody else filming something and they feel out of control, so they feel the need to assert control.
Yeah.
And that's what we're running into with both of these situations. You know, somebody wants to exert control, and that's not our job.
Well,
yeah.
I'm going to go with this. There's sort of like two factors involved. One is experience, and I think that what Jim was saying before really speaks to that experience of, you know, when you've been in the field enough, you get surprised. There are things that appear, and they're not what they appear. When you get that guy who looks like he's a homeless drunk or an indigenous, you know, one of the indigenous street life, and it turns out that he's a guy whose blood sugar dropped, his clothes got dirty because he fell in the street, and he's a perfectly well mannered person once you get some dextrose in him. So it's those sort of surprises are what sort of season you. And one of the things that Jim and I were talking about weeks ago was that you get the people who get on the bus, they've had a month of experience, and they want to seem just as burned out as the guy who's been there for 20 years. And, you know, they cop the attitude, and they start acting. Right, and then they start acting that way on the street without the experience of knowing that not everything is as it appears to be.
Yeah, they'll get a call like that. With you get a, you know, they know it's let's say a prostitute area or a drug area, and right going into it, they've got this. They're so burnt out from it already that they don't want to be bothered with it. You know, they have that attitude with it. I mean, everybody I think gets a little of that mentality when you're going to those areas over and over again, and you're getting the same drunks over and over again. I mean, who knows how many times they might have even had this woman. You know, and who knows what her deal is. Maybe she's somebody who commonly or often fakes being unresponsive. Who knows what the situation was. But the thing is, we have that perception issue. And I think that's what we have to kind of guard against, you know, being out there, is that we have that perception issue, and we have to think that, you know, the camera might be on us at any time, and we have to, you know, act as professionals at all times and not try to take those shortcuts and not try to, you know, to have that attitude, because then that's when it comes back to get you. You know, even if you're 100% right, and the video is just not really flattering. You know?
Well, but that's the problem as well.
Yeah, the problem is the experienced people who are able to get a quick read on what's going on, but don't do the full assessment. They set the bad example that is picked up by the new people, and they say, oh, yeah, I need to be doing these doorway diagnostics where as soon as I see the person, I decide bogus, not bogus, and where I'm going to go from there. Some of the places that were the biggest sin, you know, the biggest sin is considered to be fooled by a patient. Oh, they didn't need morphine because of this or that, or they weren't really unconscious.
Right, they weren't fluttering out. Chest pain, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But we need to do a full assessment on every patient. And if you have new people learning not to do the full assessment, it's because the experienced people really aren't as experienced as they appear if they're skipping their assessment.
Yeah, but Tim, you know, that's not exactly fair, because I think that as you learn and as you get more familiar with what the jobs that you have and the medical conditions that you face, and even the ones that, you know, are really the zebras in terms of medical conditions, there is a lot of information that an experienced practitioner picks from the doorway that somebody who has no idea is, you know, needs to absolutely do by the numbers a full assessment. You know, I see a person and they're pale, cool, diaphoretic, and they're not in running shorts. They're sitting on their couch. I'm pretty sure that they're having a volemic issue of some sort of another. I mean, it may be cardiac related. It may be something else. But I don't have to take the blood pressure.
And it works that way, but not the other way.
Right.
You don't have the patient where you walk in. You don't have the patient where you walk in and you see them and you don't see anything wrong, where you know that there's nothing wrong.
Right. And that's where experience versus inexperience kicks in.
Exactly. And the experienced person will do the full assessment. And if you look at the chart of a good experienced person, that chart will be thorough in documenting all the pertinent negatives. What you see with a lot of the new people is a 5-line chart or a 10-line chart that doesn't cover the real assessment. How do they get away with that if they've been mentored appropriately by experienced people who know what they're doing?
Yeah.
Well, that just comes down to, you know, the back statement of we own this. I mean, you know, and to keep in mind, you know, going back to the camera just a little bit full circle, I knew two good EMTs who got fired because they were seen on a YouTube video at a well-publicized fire that occurred a couple of years ago, and they were basically what they don't show is that the firefighter picked up this unconscious kid and basically threw it at these two guys. They took him. They threw their EMTs. You know, the kid was breathing. They threw an O2 mask on him and rushed him over to the medic. What was picked up on the cell phone video camera was that the mask came off, and it looked like they were haphazard and they didn't cover the kid and they didn't do, you know, all the stuff that normally an EMT standing alone would do. But taken in context, what the hell? You know, they're there. They have higher medical authority there. They have an unconscious kid. What else are you, as an EMT?
But that's what I think, Josh, that's what it boils down to. And I think we're pretty much all in agreement is that, you know, there is a perception issue going on, you know, and maybe they didn't do anything wrong, but the perception was that something was going wrong and something wasn't being done the way it should have been, and that's why we have to always, you know, be aware that, especially nowadays, how it's increasing, it's becoming more and more easy for people to whip out a camera and take a, you know, just quick video or snap some pictures, to be professional, like Tim said, you know, everyone get that assessment, not be the even be the experienced provider who cuts the corners and kind of passes on that attitude to the less experienced people, you know.
Because the cautionary tale is that even if you were doing the right thing, which would show up in your documentation if you document correctly and if you're doing the right thing as per what Tim was saying, but even if you show up and it looks like you're doing the wrong thing, okay, you know, I mean, years ago a precordial thump would have looked like assault for crying out loud. Now it's picked up on a video camera. At least you can defend it. At least you're acting professional. Well, you're doing the things you're supposed to do, and you can defend your moves.
You talk about something being caught on video and management doing the wrong thing by firing the people because they're giving in to political pressure rather than doing a competent assessment. They're doing exactly the same thing that I'm criticizing the people who are not doing a full assessment. They're not finding out the facts, or they're not caring about the facts, and they're just making, you know, coming up with punishment or firing somebody to satisfy political pressure. That's not competent oversight.
You know, Tim, I'm learning this, and I've learned this lesson over the last year, which I won't go into the very hard way, is that management has their own set of priorities, and they're not always they don't always coincide with what our priorities are. So what appears to be doing the right thing or doing the wrong thing, well, you know, they have their bosses too, and they have, you know, their metrics too. And I'm not going to fully sit here and defend management, but I'm going to be more understanding of where they come from, because I'll be honest, I mean, I don't feel always like it's the most fair of situations. I don't feel like, you know, what I'm given to do is always given the number one call, but it's, you know, they're representing the interests of the entities that, you know, we have to work for. And so, and we're not always given, you know, they don't always discuss with us the high plan of the organization that we're in. You know, we're a little bit of the soldiers on the ground. We're not the, chief in the high hut. So,
you know, Josh, when they don't put the patient first, they're not doing what's best for the patient.
Well,
then
what
are we doing?
What if putting the patient first is in conflict with putting the organization, continuing the organization?
Then we need a better
organization. Not, well, hey, now we're getting into a different subject.
I think so, too.
When the needs of the organization, we are there for the patient. When the needs of the organization conflict with needs of the patient, and the reason we exist is for the patient, then we have a bit of a problem. And there is not a simple solution, but protecting the organization at the expense of the patient is not the way we should be doing things. It certainly doesn't pass medical ethics.
Yeah, I don't think that people should be getting fired for, you know, political reasons. I mean, you know, if someone's caught on tape doing something, and I think that's when the documentation should be coming into play, and then they should be able to defend themselves based on the documentation, you know, versus whatever might have been seen on a video camera somewhere.
Right.
You know, and I understand management has their cross to bear, but, you know, you still have to, you know, think about what happened with, you know, we're here for the patient care. So if someone's accusing your employees of not giving proper patient care, then that should be proven beyond just, you know, a snapshot or beyond just a 2-3 minute video.
And
well, we have too many people who... many people who give in to the political pressures rather than communicating, this is what really happened. And you know how things are in New York City. When you find out the backstory on so much of what happens there, it's so much different from what hits the headlines. What needs to be done is to say, let's get all the people to sit down, explain to them what's going on, and then if we can get agreement, go to the press as a group and say, this is what happened. If we can't get agreement, then you still need to negotiate, try to figure out what you can do to get as close to agreement as possible. But it seems like as soon as something that grabs the headlines happened, you've got one group on one side saying this
fired,
is evil.
Offended. Exactly.
Yeah.
I wonder.
Not just that, but that it's evil. It's as bad as possible, that there is no possible redeeming value from the people they are criticizing. And at the other side, they're saying, oh, no, they're saints. You know, they once one-handed lifted a car off of a family. And in the middle is the truth. And we've got to stop being afraid of the truth and do a better job of communicating to people, because the public is not really that stupid. They just get their information without getting any filtering, without getting any explanation.
I've always found that the PR for EMS from stuff like goes on is never any good. It's always somebody getting fired or suspended. There's never an explanation. There's never anybody sticking up for anybody. Or like you said, sitting down and figuring out what happened and then coming to an agreement and going to the press with it. But I always find that fire departments always seem to have a much better way of getting the explanation out there, so that in the end they look like they knew what was going on, they knew what they were doing, and it was just a perception-based fault going on. I've seen it happen, you know, in the past with errors that have gone on in fire scenes, and, you know, and people just wind up walking away from it. But when it comes to the EMS, someone always seems to be getting fired or suspended or reassigned someplace or something like that.
The hammer and the axe are much bigger and quicker.
Yeah, we've got poor, I think, PR when it comes to that stuff. So, but I think, you know, I think we need to just keep an eye out for that stuff going on. We have to keep in mind that we have to stay professional, you know, and not wind up being on a videotape. You know, I mean,
you can't help being on a video. I think now, instead of watching out for the cell phone camera, it's more of how many different angles can we get from all the different people who are filming it.
Yeah. I always try to take my right side. It's my better side, I tell them.
Yeah, right. Well, but it also, I mean, in the city, everybody has security cameras on the buildings. So,
sure.
You know, every street corner. And they do this, and, you know, what we're used to is seeing this stuff from England and different areas that were much more progressive with cameras and such. But we're really catching this now, and it's coming home to roost here. And, you know, I guess the point here is that, yeah, you got to be aware that the cameras are out there, but, you know, you got to also be aware that regardless of what's picked up, it may not be fair, and you have to have a second, you know, a second and a tertiary response to what is filmed.
And I think as long as we do the right thing, and that's, I think, the bottom line, and we do what we're supposed to be doing, we do our jobs and act as professionals, that we don't really even need to really worry about the cameras and the video, you know.
We still do need to consider them.
Well, yeah, but the Rashomon effect. Rashomon was a movie from the 1950s by Akira Kurosawa, which was based on an old Japanese book, which is about a rape from four different perspectives, and each story is told. And right. This has been redone many times, but you watch one story, and you're certain that one thing is the truth. You watch the second story, and you're certain it's something different. The third is different, and the fourth is a further variation on the same story, all with different conclusions. So we have to realize that even if we have several views on film of start to finish, we're not seeing everything.
Yeah. Well, you know what, Tim, it's funny you joined us tonight, and that kind of, I think, opens up, I think, with the last little topic I want to try to jump in on tonight. And I've been reading a couple of your posts on the treatment refusals, and I know you got that from Medic Madness, started you off on that topic, and I was reading your post, and I think you posted another part of it today.
Yes.
On people refusing, if, you know, people being able to refuse treatment, you know, when they're hypoxic or if they're drunk and things like that, based solely on that and not on their mental status, not on their full assessment. So
well,
I thought
rather,
interesting
rather
that you joined
than,
us tonight for that.
Rather than just say, okay, their pulse ox number is 89 or even 70. We need to have our assessment show that the patient either is competent, has the capacity to make an informed decision, that they understand enough about what's going on, which requires that we be able to give them adequate information. Some patients already know all about what's going on with their medical condition, but we need to be able to get them to explain to us what they understand, what the risks are, and that they're making a reasonable decision. And if their SAT is 70, does that change things? If they're making complete sense and you hadn't put a pulse oximeter on them, you would let them refuse care. You might disagree with their decision, but just because you put the pulse oximeter on them and it shows you a number that you think is incompatible with a reasonable decision, we're saying, oh, that number is more important than my full assessment.
Well, but that's sort of why the entire RMA protocol got changed a few years back here in the city. I mean, because people were taking people out of their homes just because they were over the age of 65 and they could. And,
yeah.
You know, it didn't matter if you were
under
18. There are certain with under 18 and not being an emancipated minor, there are certain things going on. You know, there's certain legal obligations.
But the police do it all the time.
Yeah, right. You know, we do
so
have consideration.
We have ways around it.
But I was more shooting at the end of, you know, I still remember this so vividly because we had a 107-year-old woman who basically had a fever. And my partner was this overzealous medic who was like, you've got to go because you're 107 and have a fever, and you obviously don't know how to take care of yourself. And she's there with a home health aide, and she basically told her to F off. And it was the funniest thing. I was doubling over. I mean, this lady was just standing up to her, and I was like, I felt awful about it. But, you know, there's a certain aspect that you have to go in step with your partner. And at the time, my partner was correct. We had the authority, we had the ability to say, well, we don't agree with you, so we're going to take you anyway. And, you know, then, you know, a year and a half later, years later, they changed the RMA protocol. So anybody that was ANO times 3 and can prove it could RMA. And but I still think of that time. And it was one of the funniest statements in the world because somebody said, oh, Vaya con Dios. And she said, Vaya Diablo. Here's a 107-year-old lady who didn't want to leave her home and had a fever. So she was going to take the Advil at rest. Big.
She's saying, as long as the fever is lower than my age, I'm not going anywhere.
you know, yeah.
And but what about medical command for that? What about medical command for that? Would that have been acceptable, or did the protocols prevent doctors from thinking also?
No, it would have been 100% acceptable had she chosen to call medical control, but, you know,
because there are some places where that doesn't work, where the protocols say, even with medical command, you may not do this, which I think is the craziest thing we could come up with.
Yeah, well, what doctor would agree to that? That's a doctor.
Well, so doctors write those protocols.
Yeah, but who's ever writing them obviously doesn't trust anybody in the box. You know, doesn't trust the MDs in the box. That's your medical control
exactly.
Making at the time. That's the same.
Well, and the other issue
exactly.
is a lot of times
hey,
they will. Yes. They'll have a. I'm sorry, what was.
Yeah, Bob.
Oh, I was just going to say that a lot of times that the medical director that writes the protocols, brand new residents and interns are the ones in charge of answering the radio. And
in Pennsylvania, you've got to be at least a second-year resident to provide medical command.
Okay.
And you have to be credentialed in the protocols for that, or is it based on what the medics are calling in?
There are very few things that we need to call for permission for, but when we call, when we do call in, it's usually a strange situation where we hope to be speaking to someone experienced, and then a lot of times we'll get a number of ridiculous questions that don't have anything to do with the situation we're in. So when it comes down to, you know, does this patient need to go to the hospital, or is this a patient that should be chemically restrained, who's not violent or an immediate threat to us, that should be taken to the hospital because of a psychiatric illness or something like that? Or is this someone who's within their right to refuse? Then a lot of times the people that are answering the radio in a number of services I've been with aren't really prepared to answer that.
Right.
Rather you just transport.
Well, the call that was on Sean's blog, Medic Magnus, was a patient who was having trouble breathing but insisted on going to one particular hospital. The doctor at that hospital said, you may not come here, we're on divert.
Yeah.
As I understand it, this was in Massachusetts, and in Massachusetts, as with probably every other place, divert is a courtesy. They
sure.
may not refuse a patient.
Right.
Their alternative choice was to have the patient go POV, and they would follow in case anything changed on the way. And, excuse me, one problem was that he got in trouble for even considering that this patient should have the ability to make decisions about her own care. Most respiratory patients I know have a history of respiratory problems, and they know better than I ever will what it's like to not be able to breathe as well as they would like. I don't feel that I should be taking their decision-making away from them unless I have a very good reason.
I agree with that.
What about
the key statement to agree with?
What about the people that say, but if the patient has, let's say, in the case, we'll say pulse ox, you know, pulse ox of 70, and they're refusing to go to the hospital. Some people argue that, you know, the patient can't refuse at that point, because if a person that can reason, that if you explain to them that a pulse ox of 70 was not good for them, that they would want to go and get treatment, that they would refuse.
Jim, but, you know, there's a little bit of bullshit with that, because what's the first thing you're taught as a medic? Treat the patient, not your equipment. You know, just because you know, something on monitor doesn't mean you start whipping out drugs and pumping the patient full. You know, how are they doing? What's their mental status? What are they doing? If their mental status is, as Tim was saying, A0 times C, I don't understand how you could even conceive. Because you see it and you think better for them.
Well, I guess you have to. I guess you have to see their color and stuff as well.
Even if the coat's crappy.
My
if
grandmother.
Like, holy hell. go ahead, Tim.
My wife's grandmother gave me a whole new perspective on this, where she had scarred lung tissue from working in a factory, and in her 70s, she would turn blue every time she stood up from her chair in her small apartment. And we would take her to the doctor, her pulse ox would be in the 70s, and she looked horrible, but she wasn't going to get any better. She'd been to the hospital, we filled out all of the advanced directive paperwork. She knew that, you know, there was nothing that could be done that could make her feel better than she was that day. And she was completely alert, and we would go with her to doctor's appointments, and they would say, we need to call 911. And I said, no, you absolutely do not. And so, yeah, you can. Now, if it's a young person with no respiratory problems, that for some reason their pulse ox is 70, that might be different. But for chronically ill people, you know, our bodies can adapt to abnormal vital signs that don't fit into the textbook for a long time.
Bob, what if that young person with the pulse ox of 70, all right, and keep in mind we're not even including in the realm of equipment failure. You know, you're getting a pulse ox of 70. You're pretty sure that your equipment is not malfunctioning, but that person's NO times 3 and can give you, even if they can't give you a good story, but in this case, I'll let you slide and I'll say they can give you a good story. They have congenital heart issue and they have a low pulse ox. What are you going to do?
If they don't want to go to the hospital and well, first of all, there's an art to getting people to go to the hospital. And the case that Tim was talking about, that was absolutely ridiculous. I think that medic was absolutely right to transport that patient to whatever hospital they want to go to, no matter what their deferred status is. But in the case of a young person with a congenital heart issue, I would have no problem refusing. Now, I would clearly explain. I would probably spend at least 20 minutes trying to explain to them why it would be a good idea to go to the hospital. Then I would call medical control, explain, look, you know, and having been asked the questions as many times from medical control as I have, I know what, you know, I know all my pertinent negatives. They're aware that this could be a life-threatening condition. They are aware that it's in their best interest to go to the hospital. They are refusing. And then are they going to be operating a vehicle after we leave? And I try to... You know, if they're in a public place, I try to make sure they have a ride to somewhere or that someone's going to be with them. I cover all those things before. And if all those things are covered, that's fine. That's their decision.
You're not working at the nuclear plant tonight in the control room.
Exactly.
Well, I think like I said, too, though, Tim, if you have patients and based on what we find on assessment and both by using equipment that we have and our actual physical assessment and what we're looking at, and the patient knowing their condition. Even like you just said, Josh, if you have a young person who says they have some type of an issue that might give them a low pulse ox, they know their condition. They know that there could be, that there could be a reason for something like that going on. And we have to take that into consideration.
Yeah,
we have to take all of that as part of the picture that we're getting and that we're going to be painting, if we want to call in med control to get their green light to let this person, stay home. And what we're going to be documenting is the entire picture and not just focusing on one or two little things. And even the ANO times 3 thing, how many times do you get old people who don't know what year is, who don't know who the president is, who don't know these things? And, we have to think of ways, I think, to better assess people's ability to reason rather than just using a simple, ANO times 3, type of tool.
I'm much more interested in their understanding of their medical condition than whether they know what year it is or who the president is or what day of the week it is, because there are times when I ask these questions of the patient and I stop and I think, it's like, yeah, you're right, I was wrong. How can I then take their rights away for giving the wrong answers when I don't even know?
Well, we come back full circle on a lot of this stuff, and I know that we've discussed in the past why we have online medical control. They're our backup. So if we're at a point of indecision, pick up the phone, make a call. It's funny how...
I agree. I get them on the phone a lot to talk with the patient.
because if you want somebody to go, sometimes they'll listen to you and they'll say, no, 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 absolutely not. You get them on the phone, and it's like, oh, yes, doctor, whatever you say. Doctor.
Right, 5 seconds, talking to the doctor,
there
ready to go.
There are some doctors who just refuse to talk to patients. They're like, what do you mean you want me to talk to the patient? Like, well, I've always done this. It's
and
a good thing to do.
Because you know that's a tool that you can use, and they're refusing to give you the tool.
Well,
no,
usually they agree to talk with the patient after I explain why, but it amazes me that I run into doctors who have not done that before, who think it's something they should not do.
What's that?
Talk to the patient on the phone.
Oh, really?
Because if they speak a language that I don't speak, and unfortunately I only speak English, so that's all the other ones, sometimes the doctor at the hospital speaks the language, and that can be very helpful.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a tool in our toolbox, and it's sometimes an underutilized tool, but it's still a tool that if we keep in the back of our heads, when we need it, we should be using it. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, I mean, medical control should be a resource that we use more than just calling up for, trying to get an order for something. It should be used as a resource for a lot of other things. And, I think that all should be in conjunction with, doing a full assessment of a patient and being able to tell them something when you do call them, not calling them because you don't
right.
have to deal with it type thing.
Right.
And
if we're explaining
to the patient what's going on, and we're telling them about having a low pulse oximetry number, how much information do we have? Do we understand about what the pulse oximetry means to be able to explain to the patient to get the patient to make an informed decision? Because a lot of people have all sorts of beliefs about what pulse oximetry measures that are not true, and that includes plenty of people in EMS, even plenty of people in the hospital.
Well,
there's also a very good talk. It's about 10, 15 minutes long at Free Emergency Medicine Talks. Dr. Farhad Kapadia is the doctor, and it's from the end of last year. It's on hypoxemia is not in itself dangerous. And basically what he's saying is that there are plenty of cases of people with low pulse oximetry or low oxygen tension, depending on whether you're measuring the blood gas or pulse oximetry, and they're fully awake and alert and oriented and stable. The problem is when something changes, first thing we tend to do is turn up the oxygen. And then the SAT gets better, and we say, oh, okay, everything's all better. Instead of realizing that the reason the oxygen saturation dropped is because their underlying medical condition changed, and we need to figure out what's going on with their underlying medical condition or get them to somebody who can figure out what's going on with their underlying medical condition and address that rather than just making the numbers pretty. Because that's not patient care. That's just making the numbers pretty.
Making things so it looks good. Well, listen, guys, we're almost out of time. So I want to thank you all for joining tonight. And I think we got a lot of great points out there. I'm going to put links, of course, to the articles and these blog posts and whatnot on the blog page when this gets posted on Wednesday. So listeners can look more into this and read some more on all this, what we talked about tonight. Tim, anything you want to mention before we head off to the evening?
No. This is great. We were very thorough, I think.
I think so. Bob, how about you? Anything else going on you want to share?
The only thing, just with especially the videotape case, Tom Dick's book, People Care, just absolute essential resource. On how to act professionally, and just kind of gives you, when you're surrounded by the negativity and the burnout and people that are nasty to patients, that just is a great wake up.
Okay, I'll put a link to that book on the site so people can check that out. The last time you mentioned a book that we talked about during the show, and a lot of people sent me some emails that they love being able to just see the book and be able to, you know, get access to it and buy it if they want to read more about what the book is about. So I appreciate that. So I'll take a look and get a link for that to put on the blog post as well. So, well, Bob, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. You're over at
EMS Patient Perspectives.
Right, exactly. Okay. So I'll put a link to that blog as well. You can go check you out over there. It's got some good posts over there Bob's got, and he's sharing with everybody. So, all right, guys, just about out of time. So, again, I appreciate you guys showing up. Maybe we'll see you next week.
All right, sounds cool.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Have a great night, guys. Well, guys, that's it for us. Again, thank you for listening live if you did. If you listened to a recording of the show, I appreciate you taking the time to listen to a recording. All the archive episodes can be found at EMS12sellers.com, and also EMS12sellers is also available on iTunes as well. And you can also find us over at ThePromedNetwork.com as well. So until next week, guys, this is Jim Hoffman from EMS12sellers, and as always, stay safe.